Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly radio magazine of the performing arts. I'm David LaTulipe. This week I'll be talking with internationally acclaimed actor Roger Grunwald about his one-man show, The Obligation, in which he explores the Holocaust through his portrayal of characters and the way their lives are affected by the atrocities of World War II. I'll talk with Spanish conductor Pablo Eras Casado, who has returned to the San Francisco Symphony podium to conduct music from French composers inspired by his own homeland of Spain. The concerts this weekend will include Ravel's Bolero, as well as Debussy's Andalusian postcard, Iberia. Also Spanish piano virtuoso Javier Perianis, who performs Bartók's third and final piano concerto from 1945, coincidentally. Also stopping by is comedian Marga Gomez to talk about Latin Standards, her 12th and final work in the solo performance genre, in which she explores the loving, funny, and true story of perseverance and creative addiction passed down from her immigrant father to his lesbian daughter, as she describes life as a child of a blustery Cuban showman. It's a show at the Marsh. Plus, I'll talk with incoming artistic director of the San Francisco Contemporary Music Players, Eric Dudley, about their full afternoon into evening concert this coming Saturday at the Taube Theater, celebrating the music of Elliot Carter. Stay with us. It's a pleasure to welcome to Open Air internationally acclaimed actor Roger Grunwald, who explores a world gone mad in The Obligation, his riveting, immersive, one-person staged drama. It's been praised as astonishingly relevant by the Huffington Post and lauded by the San Francisco Examiner as flawlessly performed and elegantly directed. Roger is a veteran theater, film, television, and voice actor. His television credits include HBO's Vinyl under the direction of Martin Scorsese and ABC's One Life to Live. He's been heard in several documentaries as narrator, including in Normandy, The Great Crusade, The Nuremberg Trial, War Crimes on Trial, and HBO's Erwin Rommel, The Strange Death of the Desert Fox. He starred in the short film One Good Pitch that premiered at the Tribeca Film Festival and recently appeared in ACT's production of Heisenberg. Such a pleasure to welcome you, Roger.
Thank you, David. It's good to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Some very, very haunting music that we opened this segment with. Tell us about that authentic music from Bialystok.
Yes, there were very few extant or uncovered songs from the ghetto in Bialystok. And this particular song that you just played, Das Lied von Bialystok Ghetto, was the song of the Bialystok ghetto. The author is unknown. And it was composed from everything that people can determine in the summer of 1942. And it's performed in this recording by Loika Tsakis. It is a very haunting melody. Unfortunately, we don't know that much about, well, we don't know anything about the author, and we don't know much about the history of this song, but it's the only thing that I was able to uncover that actually, you know, was a song from Bialystok, because the central character in The Obligation is a Polish Jew by the name of Shmuel Berkowitz. It's fundamentally his story in The Obligation.
And you're interweaving that story along with the half-Jewish lieutenant in Hitler's army, a high-ranking SS officer, and a Jewish-American comedian who acts as the play's chorus.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk a little bit about some of your source material, which includes, no doubt, stories and literature writings from your parents.
My mother was a German Jew, and she survived Auschwitz. She was an inspiration, as was her sister, my aunt, who survived Bergen-Belsen. That was the genesis of the writing that I did, which has led up to the creation of The Obligation. Started with their work because they, as many survivors have done over the years, as you probably know, spoke in front of young people, high schools and colleges, to make sure that what happened to them and what happened to those who perished wouldn't be forgotten.
I should say that just learning about this, an astonishingly 41% of Americans don't even know what Auschwitz meant, and 66% of reportedly millennials, no idea.
Yes, it's a staggering and disturbing, terrifying statistic. Well, if you couple that with the fact that 41 states out of 50 don't require any kind of Holocaust or genocide education in the public schools, whether it's middle school, junior high, or high school, we're graduating generations of young people who are ignorant and not through no fault of their own of this terrible history that we need to remember for a whole host of reasons. What's happening in the world today is frightening enough. But if we're these young people, ignorant of this history, are going to be prey to the organized folks on the side of intolerance and racism and anti-Semitism, so we got a lot of work to do. So, which is one of the reasons that I'm hoping to launch a national high school and college tour of this play.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we could spend an hour on the educational system of this country. It's still just astonishing to me that, you know, you think of, you know, you had your education in the United States. No, you had your education in 50 different states that have entirely different educational standards for their children growing up.
Yes, absolutely. Well, there's an interesting educational element in the play. The SS general that you referenced provides a disquieting civics history lesson to the audience in one of the more provocative elements in the play. He reminds the audience how America's Jim Crow laws provided a model for the Nazi lawyers drafting the Nuremberg laws, which proved to be the foundation for the final solution and ultimately the extermination of 6 million European Jews. So the United States, and this isn't something that we're taught in school, the role that we played in providing that model. There's an interesting book that just came out, which I wanted to mention to you and to your listeners, by James Whitman, who's a Yale professor. It's called Hitler's American Model. Extensively researched, and it goes into the particulars of how that.
Well, then
came
we could
about.
Go spend another hour on IBM and Texaco and all kinds of
Chase
things.
Chase Manhattan, yeah. Standard Oil of New Jersey.
Yeah, it's things that we just have blinders on about.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, the obligation, where that word comes from, why I've chosen that as the title of the play, has a lot to do with, again, the history that my mom and my aunt and other survivors have, namely that they felt obliged, they felt obligated to teach, to reach out to young people to make sure that what happened to them, what happened to those who perished, wouldn't be forgotten. And in some sense, I feel responsibility and a privilege as my mother's son to continue that. I'm not a survivor, but I can leverage the power of the theater to touch people. That's my intent, and that's what I'm hoping to do here in San Francisco at the Potrero stage on 18th Street through November the 4th, which is our closing date, which I hope people can make it to before then.
Indeed. We need to talk a little bit about the different characters that you actually inhabit. You've been praised for having an almost Meryl Streep-like ability to inhabit these people.
Well, it's a humbling thing for
Meryl Streep at Roger Grunwald prices.
Yes, that's a good way of putting it. Yeah, well, like the chorus character, is a very interesting one. Actually, I first developed part of this in a short play, which I coupled with a lecture called The Mitzvah Project, which I've toured internationally. And then it became – that short play became the basis. It was the nucleus of the obligation. So I developed this with my then-director, collaborator, Annie McGreevy, a wonderful Broadway actress. And this, we came up with the idea of this chorus, and the chorus is a Groucho Marx-esque Jewish American comedian. Now, it's in the great tradition of Greek theater, classical Greek theater. The chorus provides observations and commentary on what's going on. In this case, it's a acerbic, sardonic commentary coming out of a Marxian character, that is Groucho, as opposed to the other guy. And he kind of probes the boundary between the absurd and the horrific. But he's also a safety net for the audience because the tragedy, the atrocities that get recounted in this play can be a little bit unrelenting. And he gives the audience a bit of a respite. He leavens the play, if
I
you will.
I should say, yeah. Because, I mean, it's nice to be taught and educated about something, but you don't want to be beat over the head. But it's very important to have an accessible way to get this message out.
Absolutely.
Recently returned from Amsterdam. Tell us a little bit about that trip and how it contributed to this production.
Well, in Amsterdam, I performed in another play called Anne and Emmett, which imagines a conversation between Anne Frank and Emmett Till. And for your listeners who don't know who Emmett Till is, in 1955, he was a young African-American kid from Chicago who went down to visit his family in Money, Mississippi, and allegedly whistled at a white woman, and that woman's husband and friend grabbed him during the night, took him to a barn, gouged out his eyes, shot him through the head, tied a cotton gin around him with barbed wire and threw him in the Tallahatchie River. He was murdered. He was lynched in 1955, 10 years after Anne Frank. So that's that was the conceptual framework for this play. I play Otto Frank in that play, and we've done it all around the United States, and this was the first time in Europe, in Amsterdam. As it turns out, my mother, again, born a German Jew, and her family left Germany in 1938, hoping to get to the United States, but they couldn't get visas because most visas were not, you know, available to ordinary people. So they ended up in Amsterdam, where a lot of German Jews went, thinking that would be safe because Amsterdam and Holland was neutral in World War I, but by May of 1940, when Holland was overrun by the Nazis, it was just a matter of time before my mother's family, and not to mention every other Jew in Amsterdam and Holland, was rounded up and deported to the east to camps. My mother ended up being deported to Auschwitz. So when I was there to perform in Anne and Emmett, I visited her Amsterdam home. I'd never been there before. And I knocked on the door, and this person answered who spoke English. It turns out he was a Brit. Invited me in. I had a chance to look around the place, and it was a very moving experience for me to see that the place where maybe on that last day when they were having dinner, when they were rounded up by the Nazis, she spent her last minutes of freedom. And that performance that night in Anne and Emmett was transformative. The emotions I was expressing were not just mine, and it was my mother and Otto Frank. And I've been able to bring that to what I'm doing now. Mm. It's given me another dimension. It's put me more directly there.
I imagine also as part of your research or even your natural history and curiosity, you've visited some of the camps in recent years.
The only one I visited was Dachau because I did my junior year abroad in Munich at the University of Munich. I had to go when I was a junior in college to Germany to experience it for myself. As it turns out, I mean, a lot of the young people that I knew were very anti-fascist. Their parents are the ones who were in the war. But I never went to Auschwitz. I never wanted to. I never had the... I always felt... I knew so much about it from my mom and from what I've read. I never did.
It's extraordinarily powerful.
Yeah, I know.
Amazing.
I'm sure.
So what are we going to see on stage, these different characters that you inhabit?
Well, again, these characters interweave in the story of Shmuel Berkowitz. The theatrical conceit of the play is that Shmuel, he opens the play talking to the audience as if that audience were a college auditorium full of college students. He's telling his story. He's giving his testimony, his eyewitness account. And over the course of the play, as he talks about particular times and situations and people, they come to life. So these new characters emerge from his story, and some of them also appear, like this SS general appears because he has a particular role to play, in a teaching role. He's this drunken anti-Semite, but in his drunkenness, he reveals things about who he is and his life and his feelings of, you know, how he holds people like Himmler in very low regard. Again, they were like a den of thieves. There was no honor among them, which is not something I made up. Mm-hmm. It's fact. Mm-hmm. And there's another character that I play. He's a minor character, but a significant one. After the war, well, actually during the war, the character of Shmuel gets to meet this other Jew on the death march from Auschwitz into Germany. He's a man from Kiev in the Ukraine. His name is David. And David, like Shmuel, makes it to the United States. Like Shmuel, he lives in New York. But something happens. I'm not going to give it away to your listeners who are coming. A tragedy befalls him, and this is something that is not uncommon. A tragedy, the psychic pain and the memories that survivors have, sometimes they're such a burden, they can't live with it. And something happens to this character of David, and it's a very sad thing. There's another, David also, he and Shmuel have a dispute. And this is also a historical dispute among the survivor community. David is saying to Shmuel he will never take reparations, the German word being Wiedergutmachung, compensation for the survivors, because it's blood money. And there were a lot of survivors who would never take money from Germany because it was
guilt money, basically.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Now, Shmuel takes the opposite of, position.
Sure.
He takes it because he says they owe us. Mm. They owe us for all the killing, for the children. They owe. But David won't listen to him. Now, my mother was one of the survivors who did take reparations. Mm-hmm. But it's another interesting part of the play. I'll just mention this, too. My mother was interviewed by a psychiatrist hired by the German government to determine the level of her damage psychically, that will determine the level of her payment. So that is also played out in the play.
Hmm. How wonderful to be working with Nancy Carlin as director. What did she bring to the table or make you more aware of in your journey bringing this to the stage?
Well, she helped me develop the characters and to weave them together. Transitioning between characters can be challenging, and she had an overarching artistic vision which helped to shape the entire play. So it's both the minutiae and also the macro side of the play. I mean, she's a brilliant artist, and I'm fortunate to be working with her. She was introduced to me by a man. When I did this mitzvah project, this short play and lecture that I've been touring, I did it at the Arvada Performing Arts Center in Colorado, outside of Denver, and the artistic director there introduced me to Nancy, and that was how we got together. Because I've only been in San Francisco for 2 years. Hmm. I mean, I was born and raised here, but I lived in New York for 40 years, and we came 2 years ago, and fortunately Nancy and I got to meet each other pretty much when I got here.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Well, it's a compelling evening of theater, Wednesdays through Saturdays at 8, Sundays at 2 through November 4th. Roger Grunwald's tour de force performance in The Obligation at Potrero Stage, potrerostage.org for more information. They're at 1695 18th Street in San Francisco. I wish you a terrific run. Let's talk again sometime soon.
Yes, thank you, David. It's nice to be here.
Vi kennach de jarefanen, chob moire fardeim taten. Oi effen bronchale, si vedir gur ni schatten. Oi effen bronchale, si vedir gur ni schatten. Там стука пужна ноцо, янка вебулайн шит. Ой, отвіж, брончале, я єстем твій коханчик. Ой, отвіж, брончале, я єстем твій коханчик. Вікенних ти є рефенен, хоб мой рефардер мамен. Oy effen effen bronchale in lammer zan zusammen. Oy effen effen bronchale in lammer zan zusammen.
Music that you'll hear prior to the production of The Obligation, starring Roger Grunwald, at the Potrero Stage. PotreroStage.org for more information about those performances. It was a pleasure to talk once again with conductor Pablo Eras Casado, who's come back to the San Francisco Symphony once again. He's been captivated by the sounds of flamenco, and composers from all around the world have written music in the Spanish style. So Eras Casado decided to put a program together to conduct Spanish works by Frenchmen, including Ravel's sultry bolero, Debussy's Andalusian postcard Iberia, and added to the program, Spanish piano virtuoso Javier Parianas performing Bartok's melodious Piano Concerto No. 3. I caught up with the maestro backstage at Davies Hall just the other day after rehearsal. Here's that conversation. Maestro, such a pleasure to welcome you back to our program, Open Air.
My pleasure. It's always great to come back to San Francisco and to talk with you.
Well, we talked a little bit in the hallway before this actual interview, and is it true that this is really the first time that you've actually conducted the bolero in concert?
That is true. That was I was keeping it like a secret, but this is something very special for me, this whole program. All these pieces I've done it many times. I've recorded them and toured with them. Even the Iberia, which is the less familiar one. But it's funny that with Bolero, I've never get the chance or the context to program it, but I thought this was the perfect location to end such a great program based on Spanish-inspired music, folklore-inspired music, with this wonderful piece. And you know, I'm very happy that this my first time is here in San Francisco with this orchestra I know so well and I love so much.
Well, a piece like Bolero, it seems like you'd almost let the orchestra go on autopilot. I mean, they know it so well, you know it so well. What are you bringing to the podium that might be different, or do you just kind of stay out of the way?
Well, it's as with every piece of music, of course. Iberia is a very complex and sophisticated piece. It needs a lot of help from the conductor, a lot of work. And this one, you are right. I mean, it's once the snare drum starts, then it goes to the end, 15 minutes. But then, of course, it's very important your presence there with each of the solos, each of the sections, especially when the orchestra grows and your position to give confidence to the orchestra and strength and to keep the rhythm sharp and proud and elegant, and the melody elegant and flowing when it gets heavier and bigger and louder. It's something very, very special. You have to be there and you have to control all those aspects, but at the same time you have to know your role and you have to know how to step back as well.
Well, everyone gets a workout in this piece, that's for sure, but especially the snare drummer, who uniquely you positioned in the middle of the orchestra. Have you seen that done before, or did you just want to try that as something different?
I haven't seen that before, but I've seen different positions in different settings in some concerts I've attended with this piece, but I thought it could be somehow like when you have in a Baroque orchestra the cembalo put in the middle of the orchestra, which is like it's keeping and holding the rhythm together. When you put the harpsichord in the middle of a Baroque ensemble, and it's like the center point when and that keeps everything together. That rhythm is a kind of also conductor. It's someone who leads the big army of musicians that has behind him, and it works. I spoke with the snare drum player, and he was very happy to try, and it worked very, very well, and everyone is very happy. And also, it adds a visual element that is also very effective and very, very, very nice to see.
Well, I'm sure it's always exciting to conduct a new orchestra that you haven't had as much familiar time with. I'm sure it's also very rewarding to come back to an orchestra that you have such a nice relationship with, and you know some of the musicians, and you know what they can produce.
Of course, this is this for me. It's such a gift. I mean, every time, every occasion I come back to San Francisco, I am just counting the days to come back here, because really, I cannot think of any other orchestra in the world I've built such a relation with. I've conducted practically all the top orchestras in the world in these past 15 years, and I keep going back to many of them. But with this orchestra, the consistent relation, and sometimes even coming a couple of times a year, we've made even some festivals of two consecutive weeks on a theme. We've explored virtually every kind of possible repertoire, from early Baroque, French Baroque, to commissions, to world premieres, and we've done every possible style and every possible configuration. And it's true, they've built a strong relation with players, with the place, with the city, and on stage, but also off stage. I can count so many times that I've gone with the players to sail in the bay with some of the musicians, and so it's something really I treasure very much, this relation, and this is why also every time I come here, there is every program it's absolutely unconventional, it's challenging, it's a new chance to explore new edges and new aspects of this orchestra, and every time is a great surprise and a great music celebration for me.
Well, it's a good time to renew those ties and those relationships, because there's an opening here in a couple of years.
Yeah, I know that, and precisely because it's an orchestra I admire so much, and I think it's still in this moment when everyone used to say that, well, more or less now there's the globalization and every orchestra tends to sound more or less the same, and there's not so much personality in the orchestra playing. I think this orchestra keeps a very strong personality, thanks to it's been 20 years with the same music director, and still going on, and still making really interesting programming and challenging the audience, and keeping everyone excited and engaged, and this is unique, and this is part of the DNA of this orchestra, but this is a quality that Michael Sisson Thomas knows how to keep season after season the orchestra on its toes, and the audience as well, and I think his heritage is fantastic, but you never know. Now the next period I'll be very curious who is taking over for the next generation, the next period for this orchestra, which is it looks really very, very exciting, and I'll be very happy in any case to be here and to be back as often as possible, because I feel a very strong connection also with the city and with this culture.
Well, let's hope you're on the short list for that. This program will also feature the Bartok Third Piano Concerto with fellow Southern Spaniard pianist Javier Perez. Arianas, with whom you just recorded the work in Munich, just released this past January on Harmonia Mundi to rave reviews. Congratulations. Must be a nice reunion of a sort to bring it to the stage once again.
Absolutely. And to bring it to the stage and with this orchestra, as I just was saying, that this orchestra I know so well, and we had the chance to tour this piece not long ago, like about 7 months ago, with the orchestra. We recorded it with the Munich Philharmonic. We did 7 concerts on a tour, and now to have the chance to come back to this piece with a different orchestra, it's a great opportunity, and we've both have a terrific time together with the San Francisco Symphony, because it's a piece that is very much on our system. We've lived through this piece many times, and I'm discovering new aspects of this piece now, thanks to this orchestra. Every new chance is a new opportunity of discovering new aspects of the piece, and I'm really excited about what we are getting out of this piece together with San Francisco Symphony.
Mm-hmm. It looks like that recording also included the Bartok Concerto for Orchestra and that wonderful Harmonia Mundi recording. More work for you now at the Teatro Real in Madrid, including your first ring cycle, one at a time over a period of 4 seasons, starting with Das Rheingold in January, 7 performances. Is opera becoming something that you're more feeling a stronger calling for?
Yeah, opera, since I started conducting opera, became a very, very core part of my life and of my musical activity. Somehow I feel that, I mean, opera came to my activity, to my life relatively later, after having done a lot of vocal music, a lot of orchestra, collaborating with dance companies, theater companies, but then on the last stage to start doing opera, I used to be a singer. I started conducting choirs. I worked a lot with the stage. So for me, it's the logical, natural place to be when I'm in the pit, in the theater. So this is something I've been doing regularly since 7-8 years. And I do a lot. Still, I do a lot of operas. Still, 3-4 operas per season. And for me, it's crucial. It's very important to keep a good balance together with the symphonic work. And of course, in the Teatro Real, in the Opera House in Madrid, is one of my stronger relations. I'm principal guest conductor there, and every season I'm doing a big title. I just did Die Soldaten, the opera, the huge, amazing opera by Zimmermann. Mm-hmm. And now I'm starting this ring cycle, which is, of course, a landmark for a conductor's life, and I'm very, very, very excited. And so, apart from Teatro Real, I'm also collaborating regularly with the Berlin Opera, Staatsoper, and Wiener Staatsoper, and a few other collaborations. Sometimes I do opera in concert, as I just did Boris Godunov in the Concertgebouw. And this is something I would love to do. It's still missing in San Francisco, an opera in concert. But I hope I can experience the opera together with this orchestra in the future. Mm-hmm.
I just enjoyed some time in your hometown of Granada recently, and how nice that you get to spend a little bit more time there now as director of the Granada Festival. Tell us a little bit about that festival and how you've made that grow.
Well, the Granada, it's my hometown, as you said, is one of the most wonderful cities in the world, and not only because it's beauty, but the story is very impressive. I mean, it's been a city with belonged to the Arabs for 8 centuries, and its Jews has been there, Arabs and Christians, and so in this let's say ground, this festival started more than a century ago, and it's one of the oldest, if not the oldest, music festival in the world. And it has a unique story. In the 20th century, virtually every single big star of the music, classical music, has been there, and now for me it's very exciting to be the director of the festival, because still it's a relatively unknown festival in the world, in the international scene, and now for me it's a very exciting opportunity and a challenge to bring that festival to the international awareness and to international scene, and to make the programming something unique. And of course, it's a way to be more in touch, in contact with my city, and a big opportunity, because this is something, programming and creating relation between artists and repertoire and that creative part of this job. Let's say for me, it's one of the most exciting and things to imagine and to build programs, and where you have a 3 weeks long festival with 60 concerts and including dance, opera, recitals, big orchestras, is a great chance to let your imagination go and do something for the community and for my city.
Mm-hmm. Hometown being Granada, a lot of time spent in Madrid, international jet setting all over for conducting. Where is home for you now?
Home is still Granada, very much Granada. I have a beautiful house there in the old part of the city, overviewing the Alhambra and the mountains. It's really, and where my home is, where my scores are, which are in Granada. Still, I have my office and my library there, and my parents and my closest friends are there. So I still can call home, can call Granada my home. Also Madrid. I mean, nowadays I'm living between Madrid and Granada. Madrid is where my kids are, and my wife still works on TV in Madrid. So yeah, we have a shared, 400 kilometers distance between Madrid and Granada. We have these two homes.
The fast train is very helpful for that, no doubt.
Yes.
And it's so nice to see that you've enjoyed some downtime here in San Francisco while we've had such lovely weather.
Oh yes, this was it's been a gift. Since I could come a day earlier, and I came with my wife this time, and we decided to come on Sunday, and then Monday was a day off, and there's the chance to that normally you don't get this opportunity to have one day off and to arrive, to adjust, and to enjoy the city and this weather. It's such a wonderful thing. I mean, for me as a southern Spanish guy to have this sunny weather with not so cold, not so warm.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's really really wonderful.
Well, we look forward to these performances and your next appearance here in San Francisco. Thanks so much for taking some time.
Thank you. My pleasure. Thank you very much.
On the program, Ravel's Bolero from Debussy Iberia, from his Image pour Orchestre. Bartók's Piano Concerto No. 3 with Javier Perianas, fellow Spaniard, with Spanish conductor Pablo Haras Casado, also leading Ravel's Alboroto del Gracioso. Performances tonight, tomorrow, this weekend. Go to sfsymphony.org for more information. Boleros, ballads, and dance tunes of a different sort with my next guest, Marga Gomez. She's known for her work in solo performance and stand-up comedy, and for being one of the first openly lesbian performers in the nation. Her comic style has been described as deliciously cheeky and incendiary by the New York Times and salaciously surreal by the San Francisco Chronicle. Among other shows and appearances on Logo, Comedy Central, and HBO, her acting credits include off-Broadway and national productions of The Vagina Monologues, sharing the stage with Rita Moreno and Vicki Lawrence. Marga also teaches solo performance and is a tenured artist in residence at Brava Theater in San Francisco. Her 12th and apparently final show, Latin Standards, explores the loving, funny, and true story of perseverance and creative addiction passed down from immigrant father to his lesbian daughter. She describes life as the blustery child of a blustery Cuban showman, that is.
They're both blustery.
Yeah, I'm sure. Vivid portrayals of characters from the 60s in Manhattan to present-day San Francisco. Such a pleasure to welcome Marga back to our stage of open air.
So glad to be here. I love this show. Thank you for doing it.
Happy to have you. Well, last time we had you on, it was for an appearance in July with my guest host, Peter Robinson, to talk about King of Cuba. And now, Say It Ain't So, 12th and final. Where's that? What's that all about?
You know, okay. To be perfectly honest, I am not retiring. No way. I'm just getting started, baby. But I have written 12 one-person shows, and a lot of the shows are about my parents. And in fact, that's how I started. Coincidentally, at the Marsh, where I am now, in 1991, I wrote a piece about my mother called Memory Tricks. And since then, I've written a new solo show every couple of years about something that just really appears to me, something that is obvious that I want to write about this. I want to figure it out and explore it. I think that it would have relevance to people. And I've done that since 91. And, well, I've pretty much talked about everything I need to as one person. So now I want to, you know, I want to explore other things. I'm a stand-up comic. I want to go back to that. I want to perhaps write for more than one character. But, you know, of course, more lines for me.
Right. more than one character meaning more than one actual person, because you often inhabit many characters.
It is true. I could take place and, you know, just divvy it up a little. But the premise of the show is that it is my final farewell concert. And it's also my first concert, but it is my last one. And, of course, I've got, like, 12 more coming in Berkeley.
Well, tell us about the concert end of this, then.
Can I go to the origin of this
piece? Please, please.
Sometimes, out of the 12 pieces, some of them just happen accidentally. Some of them happen because I'm offered a commission. This show started because of that. I wasn't sure what my next solo show was going to be, but I knew that I wanted to kind of wrap it up at 12, just numerologically speaking. And I was offered a commission from a theater that I won't mention, but it was in L.A., and they were going to have all this money for a mixed media performance. And they said, well, Marga, you just can't go and tell a story. You've got to do something else. And I thought, well, if I talked about these songs that my father wrote, because my father really, in my mind, in the mind of his fans, was a comedian and a producer, but he also wrote a couple of successful songs in Spanish that went up on the charts in Spanish billboards. So I thought, if I bring in these songs, which I actually have, like the original envelopes that he would mail to himself in lieu of actually going through the trouble of getting a copyright. Hmm. People thought back then, if you send something to yourself registered, then nobody can steal it. So I had these envelopes. I had the songs. I had the actual recordings. And I thought, I'm going to do something with this. So my first thought was, I'm going to deconstruct them and I'm going to rock them out and like... And then the money didn't come through. The commission was actually sort of pie in the sky. But I was already starting to write about my father as a songwriter and other parts of his life that were just cool and happy. And I started writing. Sometimes I get downbeat, but I decided to write about all the best memories with my father and all the memories that made me go into this business in the way that he did, which is kind of versatile and micromanaging and all that. And I happened to mention this to Mark Russell, who was presenting Under the Radar Festival off-Broadway at the Public Theater, and my director of many shows, David Schweitzer, and all of a sudden Latin Standards was a thing.
Mm, interesting.
And it opened in 2017 at the Public Theater, and the Times was there. I had laryngitis that night. I was ready to be killed. I was ready to really, for sure, it's my last show, but I made it.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
So tell us about what it was like growing up with Willie Chevalier, your dad.
Well,
or is that how he said his name, Chevalier? Or?
You know, Willie Chevalier.
Chevalier.
Chevalier. Chevalier. Chevalier. Yeah, que Chevalier. But he took it from Maurice Chevalier.
Really? Was,
my parents were both like Latino Francophiles for, I guess it was part of their generation, like France was the coolest thing to be. And so, yeah, he just lifted Chevalier from Maurice. And it was wonderful. I mean, my relationship with my mother is fraught. She wanted a girly, she wanted actually more than a girly girl. She wanted a little drag queen, I think, out of me, you know, just being a Latina mom. And, you know, she'd make me wear these dresses, but I really
What's the equivalent for a tiger mom in Latin culture? I don't know. Taco mom.
A chancla mom, a slipper mom. Would take it. But my dad, you know, he made me feel like I could do anything. He made me feel loved and that I was completely perfect. And so although they both love me and parents have their reason for being not good parents, my father, even though everything was a little bit unreal that he told me, you know, he told me he was going to put me in a TV show where I played a child detective, the purple girl. But it was wonderful to grow up that way with just an imaginative father and a promise, you know, a promise maker, even if they didn't come through, because all we have is hope. So it was really great. It gave me a really great sense of myself. And then through the years, of course, I battled to keep that, you know, that ego going. my parents were both in show business, and he ran these variety shows. So I always had these very flamboyant Latino singers, and we also had female impersonators. They were very popular, even in the shows back then, mid-century. Christine Jorgensen worked in my father's show. You know, Christine Jorgensen, the world's first trans woman celebrity. So she was one of his biggest draws. I mean, this was always appreciated by the Latino culture. And Tito Puente worked with my father, all of these people. So it was a pretty awesome way to grow up.
Wow. Could we hear just a really brief excerpt from the show?
A really brief. Okay, just get the hook out. And
I might be bringing up some music underneath you, just so you know.
Oh, okay. Well, the show that I'm doing at the Marsh in Berkeley is in the form of a concert. And so I introduce these songs, and I introduce them because my concert is for people who never want the song introduction to end. So I say, this is my father's song, En el Último Escalón. It's sad, like all Willie Chevalier songs, and follows his usual arc. The woman is cruel, the man is good. And all his songs were inspired by my mom. He's always the victim, and she's the dream. And then it moves to me speaking the song over the music. And then my father says, did I ever tell you that En el Último Escalón was licensed by Muzak and now will be playing internationally in restaurants and in elevators? Muzak was the Pandora of the 60s, a background music distribution service designed to manipulate human behavior by creating new recordings of popular music using carefully chosen instrumentation and algorithms that would render these songs barely noticeable in public. They paid my father enough to buy a gold convertible Cadillac.
Nice. Written and performed by Marga Gomez, Latin Standards is directed by David Schweitzer. It's at the Marsh in Berkeley through November 18th. Information at themarsh.org. Hearing a little bit of Chevalier's music in the background. Thank you so much for coming in, Marga.
Gracias.
De todo en la vida que tu cariño me pueda robar.
themarsh.org for more information. For the 12th and final solo performance of Marga Gomez, we'll be hearing more from her, no doubt, down the road. Well, up until a couple of days ago, I would have been welcoming in person Eric Dudley, the incoming artistic director of the San Francisco Contemporary Players. He was born in Toronto, spent a great deal of time on the East Coast, but now is leading the forces of the San Francisco Contemporary Music Players, now in its 48th year. Here's that conversation recorded just earlier today. Eric Dudley, welcome to Open Air in what I hope is a series of appearances, perhaps next time in person.
I hope so, yes.
So your first full season at the helm of the Contemporary Players. Nice to also welcome someone familiar with my home state of Connecticut, where you've spent some time.
Yes, indeed. Grew up all through high school there.
I'm east of the river. I don't know if you're west of the river or where.
I was just west of the river, yeah.
Okay, I was Vernon myself. Anyway, you bring a wealth of experience from years performing on that other coast, as we call it, as conductor, composer, and vocalist, and with a variety of ensembles.
Indeed, yeah. I've been an East Coast boy for most of my life, and my wife and I are really enjoying the change of pace. We've been out here for about 2 years now, and for both of us, it's a really welcome new environment to be on the West Coast, the left coast, as they say, right?
Yeah, in the left. I think, you know, like myself, coming out here since 2002, once you try it, you're not going to want to go back. At least you'll visit.
Getting more and more like that, yeah.
you'll visit, of course, but you'll enjoy your time out here, I'm sure. You have such you're coming into such a great core of players, many of whom I've had the great pleasure to either talk with, to play with as a fellow flutist, including Todd Brody, cellist Tana Adario Barry, oboist Kyle Brookman, percussionists Chris Froh and Will Minant, as well as trumpeter Adam Luffman. Such a great core of people that you're working with.
It really is, and I think it's actually like one of the ultimate strengths of Contemporary Players as a group and as an organization. It's just that all of these musicians we have on our roster are each individual powerhouses. They're all so active in their own quarters and with other ensembles and, you know, all across the country in terms of their own activity in contemporary music. So it's kind of a wonderful gathering point for this kind of immense talent that ends up forming the ensemble.
Indeed. And things get underway, at least under your helm, this coming Saturday in a multi-pronged event that starts at 4 and goes until 10. Carter and Beyond, Invention and Inspiration, celebrating the music of Elliot Carter.
Yeah, it's actually an amazing, you know, just even sounding off that idea of this group of individual virtuosi, it's an amazing program on which to encounter that, because the centerpiece is Pentode, which is Carter's about 20-minute long, in essence, kind of a chamber concerto for 20 players divided into five groups of four. And in the piece, he basically is constantly shifting the spotlight from one instrument to another, either as solo players for certain moments or in combination with each other in small duos or trios or quartets. And it becomes a real window into the individual expressive capabilities of all of these fantastic players that we have. So it's a wonderful way to start the season and also to start my tenure with the group.
And to celebrate Elliot Carter, what a prolific composer. I mean, 40 works just between the ages of 90 and 100, and then 20 more after the age of 100. When he turned 100 in 2009, we lost him, had to finally lose him, but not until 2012. An amazing guy.
It's a pretty amazing thing, actually, when you consider his whole scope and legacy. I mean, he was more productive as a composer just in his last couple decades than I've been in my life so far. So it's a little bit humbling and daunting to approach his work all the time.
Did you have a chance to ever meet him?
I've never met him personally. I've only worked with people who have, and you know, the number one thing that I always hear is what an extremely good-natured gentleman he was and how genuinely happy he was to be having his music performed at all times.
Well, among the works of Carter's that are being performed is a six-letter letter for English horn solo from 1996. Mm-hmm. That's a very enigmatic title, a six-letter letter, as the word letter has six letters in it as well.
Yes, he really loved these almost cryptograms in words, and it points at the nature of the piece itself, since it was dedicated to Paul Zacher, the great Swiss conductor and new music champion. And it was basically just a musical birthday present for Zacher, where he did the same thing that so many other composers do and just took the letters of Zacher's name and applied them to actual pitches on the instrument, and created a musical material, an actual motif out of that to create this short piece.
Hmm. Does he offer, in general, Carter, offer keys to those cryptical composer techniques, or is it more up to the individual interpreter to figure it out?
He does offer keys, and in this one, it's right out there in the open. I mean, he basically just uses the pitch equivalents of those letters. So the letter S, and in German, that ESS means E flat. So it's the pitch E flat, and then the pitch A, the pitch C. H in the German nomenclature stands for B natural. So it's the white note B on the keyboard, and then the letter E. And then for the letter R, he does a little bit of a tricky fix and has it be Re in the solfege system, so it comes out to the note B. So that's where he just derives all of the pitches for the basic tune, and then he's able to perform transformations on that as the piece proceeds.
And also represented on the program are a couple of contemporary composers, including a talk from 4 to 5:15 on how music is made with composer Tobin Chodos. Tell us a little bit about Tobin.
So Tobin is a California-based composer, and a very exciting one. He has a real connection to Carter, just in terms of his own admiration for Carter's legacy and music, but also puts a very personal spin on it due to his own extensive jazz background. And he has already written a piece that is a direct partner work for Carter's Pentode. And so it's for the same instrumentation, 20 instruments, also divided into quartets. And that piece is called A Chord in the Chorale. And he was able to then, for this work that he's writing for us and will be premiered at this program, he was able to create another work for just five players. So it's actually a standard woodwind quintet taken from the instrumentation of Pentode. But he takes some of the same ideas from that other work of his, and now creates a three-movement piece that builds on those ideas and takes them in an even further direction.
Also on the program, fellow Canadian composer Sabrina Schroeder.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, and her work stands in, I believe, a really beautifully stark contrast compared to what else is on the program. Of course, Carter is dealing very directly with pitch and with transformations of notes and with very very old and long established ideas about manipulation of actual melodies. In Sabrina's piece, there's almost no discernible pitch aspect at all. Instead, it's an electroacoustic work that involves most of the acoustic instruments all adopting manners of playing that produce various gradations of noise rather than pitch. And then for the piano and percussion, they're actually using electronic components and shakers and transducers that are positioned on the instrument in various locations to produce the sound. So what we really get is a kind of a drama of sonic effect rather than a pitch effect. And it just creates a totally different sound world to stand in contrast to what else is on the program.
And that 12-minute work from 2016 is called Bone Games / Shy Garden.
Yeah, that's right.
So quite a full day of things going on, in addition to the open dress rehearsal of Tobin Chodos' big show, composer talk with Tobin, as well as pre-concert talk with both you and the players. It kind of helps people get their ears in a different mindset, so to speak, for the evening.
Yeah. Yeah, our hope is that we want to make each concert really an event where we have a chance to encounter the music in multiple different ways, and we can see it in rehearsal, talk about it with the composer who's living, since that's such a key aspect of what we do as an ensemble, is create things written by people who are still around to be a part of it, and just have that entire experience for the audience where they can really delve into the music beyond just reading a set of program notes.
My conversation with Eric Dudley, incoming director of the San Francisco Contemporary Music Players. We'll have another conversation with them perhaps a little down further in the season when they have their upcoming December concert, a different take on holiday music. I'm David LaTulipe. You've been listening to Open Air. Our shows are archived at kalw.org. Thanks to Neil Swinkles for producing the show. You can send me an email about the show, david@kalw.org. After some NPR headlines, the BBC News is next here on KALW San Francisco.